Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New job numbers out today are better than expected, calming fears of a double-dip recession. But the economy is still far short of the hiring needed just to keep up with population growth, and very far short of creating jobs for the millions who lost theirs during the recession. Here, President Obama today spoke about today's jobs reports from the Rose Garden.
Now, the month I took office, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month. This morning, new figures show the economy produced 67,000 private sector jobs in August, the eighth consecutive month of private job growth. Additionally, the numbers for July were revised upward to 107,000. Now, that's positive news, and it reflects the steps we've already taken to break the back of this recession. But it's not nearly good enough.
Jonathan Weissman is White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And Jonathan, you wrote before today that the president's economic advisors have been huddling to try to come up with even more ideas to increase jobs. What are they talking about?
And we will hear from the president next week. He's got a speech in Cleveland to discuss his ideas. I mean, what they're looking at is a suite of possible tax cuts for small businesses. They could do a payroll tax holiday. Remember, not everybody pays income taxes, federal income taxes, but virtually everybody does pay Social Security and Medicare taxes. And for a whole lot of workers, that's the biggest part of their tax burden. So talking about a temporary cut in the payroll tax. There's also infrastructure spending. The president today talked about investing in areas that he believes would give the most bang for the buck on job creation. The problem is, of course, money. And Democrats on Capitol Hill right now are just absolutely spooked by the charge that they're a bunch of tax and spend liberals. That's not going over well. And now, anything the president proposes is going to have to be relatively small.
Well, for instance, we hear through your writing that some of the advisors are considering additional tax cuts for small businesses beyond those included in the $30 billion small business lending bill that stalled before the Senate. The president today asking Republicans to work him on this. Republicans have crafted that as something that's costing money. The president saying again today it will not cost anything. He's talking about tax breaks, getting loans, being able to better get loans to small businesses, eliminating capital gains on investments so they can buy equipment. You say
right.
Republicans are still winning that debate.
No, I don't think that they are winning that debate. In fact, I think that, this has been classic, presidential bully pulpit time. When Congress leaves town, the president gets to go up there and say what he wants, and there's nobody to respond. In fact, it looks like the Republicans are going to relent on that. The Democrats say that they now have the votes to break a filibuster, and it will pass probably the first week they're back, which is the week of the 13th. And then they'll be moving on quickly from there. The Republicans kind of all along thought that eventually that small business bill was going to pass, and their biggest complaint was it has this small business loan facility that would go straight from the Treasury Department, and they say that smacks of yet another bailout, because now the government is going to be loaning to the small businesses, and government has become a four-letter word in this political season.
Yeah, and what about just in the minute we have you, as you said, the president's going to be speaking on Labor Day and also later next week presenting a broader package of ideas. But where are we on the Bush-era tax cuts? The White House wants to extend them for families making below $250,000. Again, Republicans saying this will hurt small businesses. They want it extended for everyone, including the very rich.
What we understand they're going to do is initially the White House and the Democrats were saying we are going to let all the tax cuts for those over $250,000 expire on January 1st as scheduled. And they were accusing the Republicans of being hypocritical because while the Republicans hit them on the budget deficit, they wanted to extend these tax cuts for the rich. Now they're going to probably change tack and say, What we're going to do is we're going to take the $35 billion from the expiring tax cuts, basically money that the rich will now be paying into the Treasury, and we're going to give that to small businesses or workers. So the tax package that the president will put together next week is likely to be paid for by those expiring tax credits, so or tax cuts. So they'll be able to say, the Republicans are for tax cuts for the rich. We're for tax cuts for
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Jonathan Weissman of The Wall Street Journal, thank you.
Thank you.
As summer starts to draw to a close, we're reminded that one of the joys is hanging out at the lake, or in this case, Walden Pond here in Concord, Massachusetts, which was tough to get into this summer. People make pilgrimages from around the world or around the corner to Henry David Thoreau's idol. But this year, heavy rains filled it to the brim, and with so little beach left, police kept visitors to a minimum. Swimmers who like to lap the pond sometimes had to sneak in through the woods. Whoops, did I say that? The problem, Walden is a glacial kettle pond. No surface water flows in or out, so there was nowhere for the rainwater to go. Kettle ponds, real like Walden Pond or fictional like Lake Wobegon, toy with our imagination.
Each kettle is interesting in its own way. Long Island's Lake Ronkonkoma resembles a bright blue meteorite impact crater smack dab in the suburbs. Pennsylvania's Lake Labouf was visited by George Washington when he was a young soldier in British uniform during the run-up to the French and Indian War. Maine's Schoodick Lake was visited by Jefferson Davis, soon to be president of the Confederacy, just before the Civil War. Some thought he was on a spy mission. Boot Lake in Elkhart, Indiana, is arguably America's most volatile kettle, having gone from swimming pond to illegal dump to sludge farm to environmental education center within the span of a century. Kettle Lake, North Dakota, was an important oasis for migrating waterfowl 6,000 years ago when the climate was drier, perhaps an omen of things to come in our steadily warming world.
That's Robert Thorson reading from his fascinating book, Beyond Walden, The Hidden History of America's Kettle, Lakes, and Ponds. Now, these were formed more than 10,000 years ago when blocks of glacial ice melted down, carving out basins shaped like cooking kettles. If the basin is deep enough to intersect the water table, then you have a spring-fed kettle pond, such as beautiful Lake Itasca in Minnesota, actually the source of the Mississippi River. Robert Thorson is a professor of geology at the University of Connecticut. Last summer, he traveled from Maine to Montana exploring kettle ponds, and we asked him what makes them so special.
It sounds ironic, but one of the things that makes them so special is their unspecialness. There's probably 100,000 of them between Maine and Montana, and they are family-friendly lakes. They're wonderful places to get away from it all because they're not only many of them, but they're sort of chaotic in their distribution. And so you can leave the city and be gone probably no more than half an hour and find yourself in a fairly random gravel road with a little lake at the end of it.
Well, and you tell us everything anyone's ever wanted to know about kettle ponds. We get deep into the science of limnology, which is the study of lakes. Who knew, for instance, that pollen is considered the sperm of the vegetable kingdom? And pollen scientists call lake muck, that stuff at the bottom, yitya?
Yitya.
It's a Swedish word. You take us through the history of kettle ponds, important in American history at every phase, starting with the Pilgrims.
I was very surprised to find that the first freshwater experience in this settled part of the country came from kettle ponds on the outer Cape Cod. Miles Standish and his party headed off in search of the Indians they were following, and they became very, very thirsty, and they ended up quenching their thirst at a kettle pond using a kettle from one of the Indian middens or burial mounds.
And then kettle ponds went on to provide not just water, but hay that grew on the edges for the livestock, bog iron ore, cranberries.
Cranberries were really big, and most of those are from kettles.
Ice harvesting, the beautiful clear water from kettle pond.
Yes.
But beyond that, you think the most important thing that came from New England kettles in particular was a greater appreciation of nature. They launched transcendentalism in the early 1800s, a cluster of ponds here in Massachusetts. As you write, every basin filled with what was holy water to transcendentalists. Tell us more about that.
The attachment of transcendentalism to nature happened directly over the so-called Lake District in Concord and Sudbury and Lincoln, Massachusetts. And when the English or the Europeans would talk about a lake district, they would mean spectacular scenery, mountain scenery. But when the Emersonian transcendentalists were looking for a lake district, they found little things like Walden Pond and Flint's Pond.
We're all, of course, talking about Ralph Waldo Emerson and,
yes.
and then Henry David Thoreau,
clearly.
Of course, who lived in his little shack. Actually visited his little shack on the edge of Walden Pond. You remind us he didn't really live there full time. But what did he see in the Kettle Pond, Walden?
I think the easiest way to answer that question is just to read a word that I used in the epigraph of the book, and it's the word I. And here's his quote. "A lake is the landscape's most beautiful and expressive feature. It is Earth's eye, looking into which the beholder measures the depth of his own nature." Now, that could not have been written about most kinds of lakes, but it can be written about a kettle pond, which tend to be fairly steep-walled and, by virtue of their small size, set low in the woods and their steep banks, do really unusual things with temperature inversions, with sound. The acoustics of kettle lakes are different. And so the reasons that Thoreau was drawn to Walden Pond are the same reasons that made it what he called a deep blue well.
Well, and we here have been to Walden Pond. People across the country, I'm thinking Wisconsin, Minnesota, you name just about every kettle pond in the country. They've been to their kettle ponds. They know what you're talking about, that sound of you can be all the way a quarter of a mile on the other side and you can hear
voices
bounce across. But it's not exactly an eye anymore. It's something of a cloudy eye. What has happened to kettle ponds?
One of the problems is that all small lakes in general are subject to nutrient pollution. What happens is that we need nutrient. I mean, human beings need nutrient in order to function and survive. But if we get too much, we become obese and there's all kinds of health problems. So the problem is not in the nutrient that we eat. It's in the amount that we get. And kettle lakes are normally fairly low in their nutrient because they're surrounded by sand and gravel and that they don't have rivers running into them bringing nutrient. So they tend to be clean. But when they are settled, they are vulnerable to pollution because the nutrient can modify that clean state very easily.
So people suddenly, as you write there was a time in American history when suddenly it was between two wars, World Wars One and Two.
Yes.
When Americans started to get a little more recreation and started to go to the lakes for respite, more and more people than just the intellectuals around Walden Pond.
Yes.
Started with little shacks that didn't really hurt anything, but then suddenly, as
That's
you
right.
write, are rolling out new lawns
That's
with fertilizer.
Right.
What else was happening?
Well, they were receptacles for waste. People just threw whatever they could in low spots in the ground. They didn't understand the groundwater connection.
That's Robert Thorson. His fascinating book is Beyond Walden, The Hidden History of America's Kettle Lakes and Ponds. After a break, Finding Lake Wobegon. And later today, two governors who might need foot from mouth removal. That's later, back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. As summer ends, we're revisiting a conversation we had last September with Robert Thorson. His fascinating book is Beyond Walden, The Hidden History of America's Kettle Lakes and Ponds. Now, Thorson teaches geology at the University of Connecticut. He's traveled the country between Maine and Montana, dipping into these kettle lakes and ponds. You can read his blog about that trip at hereandnow.org. But it's continuing a tradition that stretches back decades in the Thorson family. This summer, Professor Thorson has been hanging out at Songo Pond in Maine. But as a child, his family spent many summers on the shores of another lake in Minnesota.
Lake Union in western Minnesota, where I was raised as a kid. And I fit the profile of the summer cottage culture kid that just rambled around the shores unencumbered for days and maybe even weeks at a time, however much we could. My parents were both from the upper Midwest, and yet we found ourselves wandering around Wisconsin and Illinois. But every summer we went back up to a cottage purchased by my grandfather for $500 in 1928. And that's where the taproot of lake culture was planted in my father and in my family, and it carried on from there.
And what are some of the things you did on lakes?
Oh, almost everything. I mean, just swimming, wrestling, playing, catching frogs, fishing, tubing, trolling for big fish.
In the winter?
Water skiing, yeah.
In the winter, lake would freeze over and you and your friends would figure out how many times you could make a car spin.
Yeah, I see you found that quote.
Yes,
what we did was I remember my buddy had an old 57 Chevy and we would just crank that thing up as fast as we could on the lake and then turn the wheel and step on the brake and see how many times we could spin it.
Yeah, so... And by the way, we're not recommending that.
No, not anymore.
But that kind of carefree culture, first of all, you'd think twice about, you know, people would dump cars in lakes. You'd think twice about
that
today.
Oh, yeah, they just dump them, yes.
And you go back to Lake Union, and it's as you write, it's sort of a bouldered up kettle now.
About half of the lake still looks decent. It's pretty much okay. They were mostly the wild rice marshes on the other side. But the bay that I remember the most is boulder-sided. People have taken out the marshes. They have steepened the shore. They've carved little places for boats. They've lined the whole thing with boulders. And it just strikes me as very sterile and very noisy.
But is that bad for the lake's health?
Well, it's not bad for the property owner who wants to make sure that their chem lawn goes straight to the edge of the water so they can go right from their bare feet into the water skiing boat. It's not bad, but it is very bad and destructive for the natural lake ecosystem. We now realize that the wetlands that fringe the lakes are an extremely important part of keeping the lake clean.
Yeah. Now, we said Lake Wobegon lives in our imagination. Garrison Keillor's only made sort of reference to where it might actually be. He, of course, grew up, you know, with lakes and kettle ponds. But where is Lake Wobegon?
Lake Wobegon is actually there in the middle of Mist County in central Minnesota. But it's not on the map, he says, because the surveyors made a mistake. So he deliberately hid the lake somewhere. But he tipped his hand in 2002. In a photo essay book, he said that the most Wobegonic town is Holdingford, Minnesota. So I went and looked into that. And Holdingford, Minnesota is in the right place, in central Minnesota near the headwaters of the Sauk River. But there's no lake there. So the nearest town with a good-sized lake where the main street is against the lake is a lake called Middlespunk Lake. And that is my stand-in for Lake Wobegon. And, in fact, on the July 4th celebration this year, Garrison Keillor held a free show and broadcast from the shore of Middlespunk Lake.
Aha!
So when I was there, I got some water out of Middlespunk Lake to bring back to Walden. And guess what I did when I was there? I took Walden water and poured it into Wobegon. Because what I'm trying to do is just let these lakes get to know each other a little bit in reality of chemistry.
Well, by the way, you've been between Walden and this fictional, maybe, Lake Wobegon. But Thoreau also made trials.
Yes, yes.
What did he do?
Thoreau developed what was called consumption, tuberculosis. He was quite ill. And before that, he was writing in his journal all the time. He was writing. But once he became ill, he sort of fell off writing his journal. And he was ill enough that his doctor advised him to go find a different climate to be in for a while. And this was typical practice of the day. But think of the places. He was advised maybe to go to the West Indies. Maybe he could go up to the mountains. Maybe he could go out to the desert. He took a very unusual decision, and he went to Minnesota. And I wondered why until I actually was there this summer and I looked at Lake Calhoun with new eyes. Thoreau, in his only trip out of the Northeast, basically got on the train, then got on the steamer, got out at Minneapolis, which was then a town not a whole lot bigger than Concord was in its heyday. And the first thing he did was went straight to the nearest kettle pond, which looked very, very Walden-like. It's called Lake Calhoun. And there he did the same thing he did here. You know, he just swam around. He sort of botanized. He smelled the pine-scented air. He just hung out at kettle ponds for a week or two trying to recover his health. And I wondered if he wasn't trying to follow his doctor's advice to actually go get some different air, but yet stay near the thing he loved the most, which was Walden Pond.
Right. Did you dab some of that water that's before us on your forehead?
Well, until it runs out, I'm going to offer it to anybody if they want to touch their forehead with it. I don't see why organized, established religions should have a claim on all symbolism.
Well, so. And people back in the day, they wanted to be baptized in Walden's
Well, that's
water.
A quote straight from Nathaniel Hawthorne. He said, I would love to be baptized in Walden Pond. It's clear and beautiful like usual. He said, but then I would not want to wash my sins off into it.
As we have done.
As we have done.
Since then. That's Robert Thorson, professor of geology at the University of Connecticut. His book is Beyond Walden, The Hidden History of America's Kettle Lakes and Ponds. We'll link you to his blog about his trip to see kettles from Maine to Montana. That'll be at our website, hereandnow.org. Professor, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Galveston, oh Galveston.
And switching, as we are, to sort of another body of water, this one. Off Galveston. Heads up, Labor Day, we're going to be here for you with all the news and a terrific show with songwriter Jimmy Webb, who wrote this song and so many others. At our website, we're asking, what was your favorite Webb song? Now, Bill Corbett writes he's been married for 41 years, still tells his wife, I need you more than want you and want you for all time. That's from Wichita Lineman. Adina writes she used to choreograph kite ballets to Jimmy Webb songs. Let us hear from you, hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
There will be no deep-fried Oreos or chocolate-covered bacon on a stick this Labor Day weekend in Detroit. After 160 years, the Michigan State Fair has been permanently canceled. Michiganians claim it's the oldest fair in the country, though New York disagrees, and they say it's also the first state fair to fold. It's been struggling for years. Last year, Governor Jennifer Granholm pulled the state subsidies for the fair, citing a $1.6 billion deficit. So this summer, fair organizers say they had no choice but to call it quits. Nolan Finley is editorial page editor for the Detroit News. Nolan, no more cows made out of butter?
No more racing pigs, no more miniature goats, and no more live birth of animals, which was what the Michigan State Fair became known for in the end.
Sure, that birthing room where you could go in and watch animals be born. Well, what's the...
You can't do that while you're eating an elephant ear, I'll tell you that.
Well, what's the reason? Is it we know Michigan and, you know, the car industry behind it that's fueled it for so long. We know it's been hurting. Is that the problem?
Yeah, it's financial. I mean, the state fair gobbled up anywhere from $500,000 to $2 million of state money. And, you know, there's not room for those sorts of luxuries in the budget, according to the governor. And this is a fair that had been on the decline for the better part of two decades, actually, in terms of attendance. It's not like the fairs you see in Ohio and Kentucky and some of our other neighboring states.
Well, you know, and entertainment is a big draw at state fairs. And we're looking at the fact that the Iowa State Fair had Sheryl Crow and Keith Urban. And last year, the Michigan State Fair had Starship and Survivor. You know, good groups, but completely different.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to turn out tens of thousands of people to the fair. I mean, the biggest draw of the fair year after year was a homeboy, Alice Cooper, was always the biggest draw. And beyond that, they could not get top-ranked national acts because they didn't have the resources. I mean, 2 years ago, they had Paul Revere and the Raiders there. It's at that caliber.
Yeah, nice. They're good people, but...
insulting them, but... And the fairgrounds itself had become a little well-worn over the years because there weren't the resources to keep them updated. And the fair is in Detroit, which is a long way from the agricultural center of the state. It was a haul for some people to get to from outstate. And, you know, the truth is a lot of suburban and rural people don't relish the idea of coming to Detroit. It still has a reputation, if you will, amongst people who don't live here as a scary place, I guess.
Well, Detroit does have a PR problem right now, just, you know, because the city is so hurting. But one of the sad things, I would think, is that this was a place, the fair in Detroit, where city and rural folk did once mingle. You know, the state did come together.
Well, yeah, and that's the shame of it, because it did have that potential. But in the end, it was nothing but a really large carnival, and not even a terrific carnival, and midway with some goats and chickens thrown in for good measure. It didn't really live up to its reputation in the end of being a celebration of agriculture and state industry. It was a midway. Meanwhile, you have smaller fairs popping up in outstate areas. They are Maida Fair, the Ionia Free Fair, that have always been fairly strong and getting stronger this year as the agriculture folks look for a place to show their wares and to compete for blue ribbons and do all the things that the state fair was originally intended to do.
Well, of course, and the sad thing there is that, again, city kids who never get to see farm animals won't get to see those.
Yeah, and that, you know, that was one of the beauties of having it in Detroit, because for the most part, there's not a whole lot of farms and agriculture around the city.
Yeah.
And for a lot of kids, it was their only time to experience that, and it has been such a great part of Michigan's history. Agricultural, still one of our top three industries. It's a big agricultural state, and, you know, there, it is sad to see this go. It did have the potential to be an end-of-summer festival, but in recent years, you've had, you know, it was always over Labor Day weekend. You had a number of other festivals cropping up to compete. We've got an international jazz festival going on this weekend. We've got something called the Arts Beats and Eats Festival going on in a neighboring county that drew off attendees and cut into the revenue that the fair might expect.
That's Nolan Finley, editorial page editor for the Detroit News, on the demise of the Michigan State Fair. Nolan, thanks.
Thanks, Robin. Good talking to you again.
Well, coming up, what's behind Arizona Governor Jan Brewer's debate meltdown? And what about Governor Haley Barbour's claims that he went to integrated schools in the 60s in Mississippi? Here and now. As our next guest says, it's been an interesting time to be a reporter in Arizona. The nation's toughest immigration enforcement law took effect back in April, promptly landing the state in court. And this week, Governor Jan Brewer, well ahead in the polls, appeared to melt down in a gubernatorial debate on Wednesday night. As the Arizona Republic reports today, Jan Brewer has been in politics for 28 years, but it took only 13 seconds to reshape her national image when Brewer, who's become a hero to conservatives nationwide, well, paused in her debate opening statement.
We have done everything that we could possibly do. We have did what was right for Arizona.
Well, that moment has taken the spotlight off another one that followed in the debate when she refused to respond to her opponent Terry Goddard's question about her claim, since proven false, that headless bodies are turning up in the Arizona desert, making the immigration law necessary. And later, she dodged reporters who tried to get a follow-up.
And what about the headless bodies?
Can you answer the question, Governor?
Why won't you recant that? Do you still believe that?
Okay, thank you all.
Governor, what do you
mean? Oh, nothing worse than upset reporters. Reporter Mark Brody joins us from the studios of KJZZ in Phoenix. Mark, what do you make of all of this? First of all, it was supposed to be a fairly, you know, kind of dull debate, we understand.
Yeah, I mean, gubernatorial debates aren't necessarily inherently compelling dramas here. Quickly into the debate, I was sitting in a room just across the hallway with all the reporters and a number of the political operatives, campaign workers. I have never heard that many people, especially reporters, be silent for that long. People were just waiting, watching the screen with the debate on it, waiting for the governor to say something.
Well, and you know, people can be sensitive to that moment. You know, who hasn't had a meltdown while public speaking? So what are people in Arizona saying? It's one thing for reporters to be sitting there holding their breaths, but what's the reaction been in the state today?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The governor's response was, you know what? My brain froze. I'm human. And I think to a lot of people that could resonate. I mean, I know that it's happened to me on the air before, and I'm sure it's happened to a lot of reporters and other media types who are live on the TV or radio at some point. The claim of it's human, I'm human, I made a mistake, it seems like that might be resonating. However, I don't know that it's helping her that much to have the clips played over and over and over again. I think since Wednesday night's debate, I've seen or heard that clip probably no fewer than 20 times.
Well, and the point is perhaps that you're not seeing the other clip, which was when she was asked again by her opponent about her claim that headless bodies were in the desert, a claim she made on Fox TV back in June. Now, as you well know, none have been found. Coroners have searched. Her opponents say those comments, which politically help support the immigration law, were disastrous for tourism. We've had reports here that prove that that's true. What is she saying about that?
Well, that clip, at least here in Arizona, that clip has been getting also a good amount of play. So I think the opening statement and, if you will, the closing statement of the post-debate, her time with the media, have been getting equally a lot of play. But what she has said about that is that what she meant was that there were beheadings in the border region. There is some evidence that that sort of thing is happening in Mexico. The concern among a lot of people here in Arizona is that border violence might spill into Arizona. But as you point out, it hasn't happened yet, at least in terms of the beheadings. None of the county coroners in counties along the border or near the border have reported any kind of headless bodies found in the desert. Now, that does contradict something that she did say in an interview a little while back, where she did specifically say our law enforcement, meaning Arizona. So, you know, whether or not that continues to be an issue, I think remains to be seen between now and November.
Well, and we spoke to one of your colleagues in town, CBS investigative reporter Morgan Lowe, who told us that while tourism is down 10% in the state, actually the crime rate is also down as well, unless, of course, you happen to be in a drug cartel. So just in the few seconds we have, how do you see this playing out?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting. And, you know, what Terry Goddard, the Democrats' campaign, is saying now is what this could potentially do is get people who weren't paying attention before to start paying attention now. The governor has a pretty big lead in the polls that we've seen. So whether or not Terry Goddard can chip away at that enough to make it close leading up to November, I have no idea. I think remains to be seen. But I don't think these clips are going anywhere so soon.
Mark Brody, a reporter and host at KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. Mark, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And this note about another politician's words. This week, Mississippi governor and possible Republican presidential candidate Haley Barbour gave an interview to the conservative media organization Human Events. Now, he was asked to address the accepted historical wisdom that the rise of the Republican Party in the South in the late 1960s was largely due to Democratic President Lyndon Johnson passing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Barbour was asked, was race a factor in people switching from Democrat to Republican in the 60s in Mississippi? Here's his answer.
The people that led the change of parties in the South was my generation.
Right.
My generation who went to integrated schools, or I went to integrated college, never thought twice about it.
Well, reporters have been doing the math. Haley Barbour is about to turn 63. He was born in 1947. That means he would have gone to high school in the early 60s, when schools in Mississippi were solidly segregated. He then went on to Old Miss, the University of Mississippi, which was famously first integrated by James Meredith with the help of armed U.S. officials in 1962. Brick-throwing white mobs rioted all night to block his enrollment. A few years later, there were still only a handful of blacks at Ole Miss. It would seem unlikely Haley Barbour or any student in the 60s in Mississippi never thought twice about race. Salon.com speculates that Barbour is whitewashing history in the hopes of reaching suburban swing voters if he runs against Barack Obama in 2012. Barbour hasn't replied to reporters' requests for an explanation of his statement. But it got us thinking about a book we've been reading and highly recommend, Bruce Watson's Freedom Summer, about the summer of 1964, when some 700 college students descended on Mississippi to register black voters, three of them immediately murdered. But they were also there to build freedom schools to replace Mississippi's segregated schools for blacks. And Bruce found now grown-up African-Americans who'd studied there.
One woman said, I remembered reading the novels of Richard Wright in freedom school. She said, you mean black people can write books? We'd always been told we had done nothing we could be proud of.
We'll have our conversation with Bruce Watson about the murderous, segregated summer of 64 in Mississippi next week. Governor Haley Barbour's memories of that time are at our website, hereandnow.org. Before we go today, the musical duo The Weepies, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to the band with the sad name but the oh-so-cheery songs. That's Hope Tomorrow, one of 14 new tracks on Be My Thrill, the latest CD from the singing-songwriting couple Deb Talon and Steve Tannen, also known as the Weepies.
We hold hands while we work and play, and hope tomorrow is a sunny day.
You may recognize Weepies' songs from the film Sex and the City, TV shows like Gossip Girl, and then there was that prominent campaign ad for then-candidate Barack Obama.
Yeah, you.
And we think we hear Deb Talon and Steve Tannen standing by in the studios of NPR West.
You hear slurp, slurp, slurp.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, is that Deb?
Yeah, it is.
And Steve.
And Steve. And I and a little one.
Yes, a little tiny one.
Did you hear him slurping?
I did. What's his name?
Alexander.
Well,
he's 3 months old.
Well, we welcome Deb Talon, Steve Tannen, and their latest production, Alexander.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And Deb or Steve, either leap in. The name, the Weepies, where does that come from?
That comes from our ambition to tap into some place where tears come from when we write Tears for Joy and Tears for Sorrow.
I cry a lot. That's really where it comes from.
Steve's the weepy.
Well, but
the original weepy.
But there is a, you know, the weepies are it's also a phrase used for that, the films from the 30s, you know, the
sure.
ones that make you cry.
That was the intent, but you're the only one who knows that. Evidently, it was like a new word. But yeah, that was our intent too.
Well, so here you are hoping to produce music from the heart. Just give us an example. Why don't you do that? Why don't you pick something from the new CD that sort of taps into that?
I love one that Deb sings called Please Speak Well of Me, which is a pretty sad song about leaving a relationship.
Don't say words that you don't mean. When I'm gone, please speak well of me.
We also hear songs that can be joyful and make you weep. I'm thinking of When You Go Away.
It was very much inspired by our oldest boy. Theo used to play this game when he was little, where he would pull a blanket over his head and then want us to say, "Where's Theo? Where'd he go?" You know, like the classic baby,
right.
Early baby game.
When you go away, it's like you hide the sun.
Go Away, the Weepies, and you know, so now here you have songs inspired by two children, but it doesn't seem like it was that long ago that you met Cute in a club here in Boston. You, Deb, came to see Steve play, and you'd both been sort of secretly admiring each other's music.
It wasn't cute, it was terrifying.
It was very frightening.
I mean, now it's a cute story, but I was such a big Deb Talon fan, and I actually had her debut CD in my car when I drove alone up to Boston to play my first show in Boston. And who shows up? Deb Talon. And I literally can't remember the rest of the gig. I know that I just was panicked.
And I was sitting in the dark in the audience, and I was equally panicked.
Because you
didn't... 'Cause I'd been listening to his album for right. the last month. It was a very charged first meeting.
It was, sure. And we started writing almost immediately together, and it was so comfortable. And we started writing together the first night.
Well, as we said, it led to more than songs, because you soon had you know, the marriage and the baby carriage, the son Theo, and you're holding, as we said, Alexander. But also the music produced the children, but then the children, as we said, have been producing the music, including a track on your new CD called Not a Lullaby. Let's listen.
This is not a lullaby.
garden for Theo?
Yeah.
Of course. He actually has a little door right by his bed that leads out into the little backyard, and it's just a naked love song for him.
Yeah. Well, and we're all good. You got the burp out.
Excuse me.
And that's Alexander there.
Just in case you thought we weren't serious, there he is.
Well, the other thing that's notable about the Weepies is that you have so many of these placements, which I'm thinking is a good thing because I know you were part of the Lilith tour and you're planning on taking the children with you when you tour. But it must be nice to have these placements in movies and television, too, so that you don't have to rely only on touring. What's that like for you to have more than 100 of these placements?
We are kind of crazy movie fans in addition to loving music, and to have our songs kind of in that magical pairing of, you know, a story that's being told and then the music comes in and sort of adds that emotional resonance that's a little bit different because it sort of has its own emotional story going on. We are just thrilled.
Yeah. And the thing about the film and TV uses is the radio doesn't really pick up bands like us. And so instead, it gets to go out into the world through film and TV and things like that. And it really takes the place of what I think radio, a broader radio spectrum, used to do.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another single off the new CD. This one is called Sunny Days. And we were thinking, let's listen, and then I want to hear from you. Hey, maybe a good show that it could be a match for. So let's listen. Deb Talon, Steve Tannen, what show?
I think the Twilight movies. I think the vampires.
Can't you see? Can't you see them? With their pale white skin.
Why not aim high?
That is a really that song. When we wrote it, was really quiet, and when we produced it, the musicians that played on it, it was just such a joyful arrangement. So I think it has a nice tension.
A professional life.
Yeah.
You like that idea too, right, Alexander?
Alexander's weighing in. Okay. Well, there you have it. Deb Talon, Steve Tannen, Alexander Talon Tannen. Let's go out with the title track from the new CD, Be My Thrill. Steve and Deb are the Weepies. For more, you can go to our website, herenow.org. And good luck with an upcoming tour and with all the kids and everything. All best.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Be my thrill, my little white pill.